Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Turned Into Punk Classics, a show where we take old episodes of Turned Into Punk that have been lost from the internet and return them to their previous glory by sticking them back on the feed. You can find this podcast on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and all other forms of social media. Well, that's pretty much it. At Turned Into Punk, you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at LeftForDamian. I play in a band. More information can be found at fuckedup.cc. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy another TOAP classic.
Or Newfoundland.
Or Newfoundland, too. That's true.
Newfoundlanders. I've never actually been. But
you've never been to Newfoundland?
Yeah, which is total fucking bullshit.
That's crazy.
Oh my gosh. I'm so angry that I've never been to Newfoundland. And it's going to happen. In fact, one of my Mao compatriots is living part-time, in, at least part-time in Newfoundland, so...
Well, you have to make it out there. Like when we went we went out there, it took us a good 3 attempts to land the plane from Halifax into Newfoundland because of the fog. And so that's an experience worth having.
Fuck yeah.
Nico, thank you so much for coming on the show. As I was just explaining to you, huge fan of your work from way back when you were just hitting the skins and to all the way to today. But I want to, I guess, you know, I could talk about just my experiences with your music the whole podcast, but no, this is about you. And so I want to start them off the way I start them all off, which is...
You might be more interesting than me, though.
No, I assure you. And anyone that listens to this podcast can definitely attest to this. I'm not that interesting beyond finding
Girl.
Cool guests.
Girl, you don't even know how not interesting I am. You're about to. You're about to know.
I'm excited to learn how uninteresting you are, Nico.
Thank you.
But I want to start them all off the way I start. I want to start this one off the way I start them all off. There's my searching for the words thing I also mentioned off air.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Same.
How did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you heard it?
God, that's hard. That's really hard. I kind of don't really remember. I think I was probably around like 10 or 11. I know I had a little exposure to the Ramones. I don't remember how. I think sixth grade, I definitely had some friends in grade school. This kid, Rudy, who was a really super funny, nice guy who sat across from me. We used to bring the record player in the classroom, and I remember he would bring AC/DC, and I think he had like his brother's copy of a Ramones record, and I cannot tell you which one, because I don't remember. But it probably would have been around like 81 or 82. Well, yeah, 80, 81, 82.
And so like, where did you go from there? Was it like, I guess it would have been just kind of, was it on rock radio at all, Ramones, for you?
Not really. I was living in Vancouver, Washington at that time, which, is not a cultural place whatsoever. Never has been. It was a suburb of Portland, and, it still is. There wasn't a lot going on there culturally at all, but I remember this kid, Rudy, who was awesome. And I remember I loved Blondie, but I didn't think of them as punk rock at all. I wasn't really thinking about genres or the differences between things at 10 years old either. And, you know, I loved the Go-Go's, and at one time they were a punk rock band, or still were.
Like, absolutely.
There was a lot about them that was punk, even if they're on the radio. Like, at the time, it was definitely considered more of a genre, I think. But, you know, and I had seen, like, footage of the Sex Pistols on the news, like, that really famous footage where they're like, look at these degenerate children with their terrible fashion. Like, things like that. Like, there's a very disturbing trend in England, but you know, basic dumb crap like that. The punk scourge. But I do remember one of the first things I saw around that time was a punk fashion show.
Oh, wow.
But at this fashion show / party, they had things like hors d'oeuvres in toothpaste tubes. And I remember them squirting something out of like an AIM tube onto a cracker. And people had safety pins in their faces and stuff. And I was pretty fascinated by it.
That sounds like a party I'd want to go to today.
Yeah, because what wouldn't be delicious out of a used toothpaste tube?
Yeah, exactly.
Which I'm sure they were just taking the piss out of whatever. Anyway, they were probably just setting it up for the media and pretending that they ate out of toothpaste tubes. But who knows? Who knows? They were just a lot smarter than that. So, you know, but as a kid, I'm like totally buying the whole entertainment kind of shock value element of it. And I was into it and thought it was pretty inventive and cool.
Did you watch any of those talk shows? Because in the 80s, they would have those like talk shows, like Parents Against Punk, like rescuing.
Oh, yeah. I was on a Seattle town hall at one point when they were trying to shut down live all ages venues. I just sat there and looked stupid. I didn't say anything, but I was representing.
You were representing for the cause.
I was all, don't shut down the monastery where underage kids buy crazy drugs and have sex. Fuck you. They kind of had maybe a little bit of a point, actually, with the monastery in Seattle. But other than that, we needed underage dance clubs.
Exactly. Well, you need somewhere for kids to go because they're going to buy those illegal drugs on the street otherwise.
Yeah, and, you know, you needed an old church run by sketchy adults to get you in there. So,
yep.
Super safe, super above board.
Hey, I look at this stuff now as a parent, and I'm like,
I was going to ask you, how does that make you feel now, some of the things you did when you were that age?
Well,
I'm going to do some poppers in a public restroom with people of various genders and ages that I don't even know and get so wasted that, like, I can't stand up that good. I think that's a great idea.
Well, I can't
starring
wait.
Me at 15.
Your wild punk story sounds way wilder than mine. I was thinking about just the fact that here I was at 15 with, like, 35-year-old friends. And being like, this is my adult friend that's just going to come home with me, Mom. And he's going to go up to my room with me and we're going to talk about records for a while. And that's what we did. But it's just like, I wonder how I'd feel as a parent when my child starts bringing home adults to hang out with.
Right. Well, that's funny you mentioned that because punk rock definitely hooked me up. And I don't mean that in the sexy way.
Yeah.
Or the creepy way. I ended up meeting a lot of older people. A bunch of whom were dudes who just thought I was a cool kid at 15 or felt sorry for me or something because they knew I didn't really have any parents or anything. And they let me hang out. And they kept me safe. Like, there's a lot of really shitty things that could have happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
But these people were just like, that kid kind of needs someone to look out for her. And these other kids are kind of hanging around. So we can kind of, I don't even know if they were thinking that at the time. But they provided a safe place, or not completely safe, you know, if you go off and do your own stupid shit. But,
yeah.
You know, it was a really positive place to be. We were checking out things people were making, not, you know, drugs and alcohol were kind of a side thing, but the music was the main thing.
And I guess even as a young person, it's like, it's really rare to be the stuff you create to be given value by adults.
Oh, absolutely.
And that happens in punk.
Fuck yeah.
So where did you go from hearing this Ramones record before you went to the poppers in the bathroom? Like, what was the middle steps, I guess?
It was a very short period of time, if I think about it now. It probably, you know, I can't remember what exactly my very first punk rock show was. It was at Guerrilla Gardens in Seattle, Washington, down off of Jackson Street by the train tracks. And it was a really awesome venue. It was really skanky, but it had two theaters in it. So, like, I remember going to see DOA and the Fastbacks in one room and No Means No and The Accused in the other room. There was the Omni room and the Gorilla room.
What an amazing
And you could go into both shows.
Oh.
It was so fucking excellent. And I just remember, like, I remember loving everything about it. And I feel like I remember Joey Shithead having a chainsaw or something. I remember he was wearing a fireman's hat and saying, "I'm your fire marshal." And I remember just the fastbacks were these awesome women and dudes, and I didn't expect to see that. And, you know, they didn't really dress punk rock or anything. So I'm kind of like, what? You don't have to dress punk rock to be fucking awesome? Well, it was kind of bending my mind. Like, I didn't really understand that you could be a lady, B, you know, playing this music. My mind was so blown. And then No Means No. I was like, what the fuck is this? It's really fucking good. And then The Accused, of course, I was like, there was nothing about that night that wasn't completely riveting to me.
Well, I have so many questions about that night now for you because, oh my gosh, did you hit on four bands that I love to talk about right off the top. But first of all, Fastbacks, how underrated is that fucking band?
Oh, about as underrated as you can be.
Oh, it's crazy when you hear them. They're like as good as any pop punk band ever or better. And they're just kind of like, they're obviously appreciated, but nowhere near to the extent that they should be, I feel.
No, but I mean, how big do you get in punk rock?
Well, but like, then you think about
like, that's something I can't really fathom either. Like,
well, you get big. Like, look at Black Flag now. Look at Dead Kennedys. Like, there's bands that become institutions, you know? And I think Fastbacks are almost deserving of that institutional status. Like, they are, I think they're, like, for the amount of time they were around, the breadth of recordings. And
you should get Kim on the show.
Oh, I want her on the show.
You should ask her some shit.
Oh, I definitely want to get her on the show at some point.
Get Kim and Kurt on the show.
Oh, I would love to. Believe me.
Lulu's around, too. Like, seriously, they would, like, I don't know to what extent they toured or anything, but that night, I just remember feeling like, what the fuck? And I remember Lulu just giving a bunch of shit to people in the audience. They were giving him some shit, and she's like, this is rock music. Fuck you. I don't know. She wasn't taking any shit off these stupid, like, young boys that were fucking with her.
That's
who
awesome.
Looked like tough older guys to me. But now, in retrospect, you're like, okay, I got to make the adjustment that these were actually pretty much children.
Yeah.
Couple 21-year-olds here and there, but
Duff wasn't playing drums still for the Fastbacks by that point, right? Duff McKagan?
I don't know who was playing drums that night. Okay. I don't think it was Duff, but he might have been. I don't know that he was in the band for a super long time.
No, I think he just plays on the first single. I don't think he's in on that first 12.
Yeah, I don't think that was him.
Okay. But another question about someone. Was it Blaine singing for The Accused, or was it Oh, amazing.
No, it was Blaine. It was great. I saw The Accused so many times.
Oh.
And that's another thing is like punk and metal were pretty much one and the same at that point.
Well, Al, that's interesting you say that because like I've always heard
not one in the same, but
yeah,
integrational space.
Because you always hear about Seattle, like the great divide that was like metal on one side of town, punk on the other side of town. But I guess that comes later, probably.
No, I think that it was still happening then, but it was not as it wasn't as pronounced. Like it just wasn't weird. I mean, there were. You know, when you're a kid, you really, really pay attention to this stuff. And, like, as we talk about it now, I realize it sounds really stupid, but, like, there was a bunch of long hairs, you know, kind of metal dudes.
Yep.
And you tell by their hair, like, that's their uniform or something. But really, you know, that's just you trying to figure out how people represent themselves as a kid. So I could say what I think was happening, but I don't think that's what was happening.
And I guess
to the extent I thought, anyway.
And I guess Accused are so good that they bridge that town divide.
Yeah. And Seattle was really small at that time. It was kind of, you know, like Canadian bands in a way, like there's only so many bass players in town or whatever. So, you know, you get in other people's bands too.
Mm-hmm.
Like Mark Arm was in a ton of bands before he was in Mudhoney, obviously. And
yeah. Did you,
they, everybody got around, you know, in a good way.
So, oh yeah, well, we can talk about, I want to talk about Mr. Ep and The Calculation.
I still have a Mr. Ep poster that literally I remember I picked up because they had taped them to the sidewalk.
That is awesome.
And it still has the little sidewalk grains stuck in it. And so, I still have that. I actually still have my whole box of old posters from then.
Whoa,
it's pretty funny.
That is not funny. That is wicked to find out. Was that theater that you mentioned seeing this show at, is that the theater, do you know that Nils from Matador and Sub Pop, you know, who does PR, that his parents owned or his dad owned?
No, I think, I don't believe that. I don't think that was him.
Okay.
But it's not impossible either.
Did you know him back then in Seattle at all? Because he was like a super
I didn't know him till a little later.
Okay.
But I didn't meet him till he had that record store. And I don't know. Did he? I'm going to find out now. I'm going to be all, excuse me. How did you not tell me?
He showed me a crazy photo one time of him at age 11, just before he went to see some insane punk show.
Was it the Metropolis?
Maybe it's the Metropolis. I thought it was some theater.
Graven Image?
Maybe it's Waven. I don't know. I could say, every venue you say, I'm going to be like, maybe that's it. Maybe that's it.
Well, I think Gorilla Gardens with its two little theaters used to be like a porno movie house, probably.
Okay.
Especially then. Down on Jackson.
Okay. Probably not that one.
I remember the owner was a Chinese guy, and he would sometimes take the money. And I was under the impression that he was the owner. So I think he was the owner, because there's not a huge chain of command, you know, in such a tiny place that the owner wouldn't be there taking the cash. You know what I mean? Plus, it's a sketchy part of town, so you probably want to make sure things are cool. I don't know. Was a sketchy part of town.
Yeah, I guess that's the other thing about punk. It's like kind of like the lichen of gentrification. Once it moves in, the condos are coming.
Yeah.
Were you inspired to start playing after that night, or had you started playing before that, or?
Well, I think that I didn't really know who or what I was yet at all. You know, you're going through that pubescent beginning. Like, I definitely, the Fastbacks blew my mind so hard. I think it just left like a hole in the film. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what to take away from that. Seeing women playing music in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I do recall not realizing that, say, Poison Ivy from the Cramps was the guitar player, even though I read that on the sleeve a trillion times. And then when I realized that, it was kind of too late. It was like, I'm so fucking ashamed that I didn't think a woman was the guitar player for this band. And so I had to really readjust my whole system. And, you know, then the glaring lack of women in the music scene was pretty harsh. It was really harsh, in fact. But I didn't start playing until I was about 17. And was kind of a little more, you know, solidly located in Tacoma. And, you know, kind of over getting super wasted and doing drugs all the time. Which was, I think I was pretty much over that by like 16.
Yeah. Well, especially for 15 to 16, that's a young period to have, a wild period during.
Well, it was more like 13, 14.
Okay, yeah.
15, 16. And I just luckily did not have a big enough attention span or something to become a good drug addict or something. I don't know what. It was like, God, getting drugs is so much work. And I'm not like, I wasn't into heroin or anything. I was into like MDA and like, we had PCP in Tacoma, but it was like the closeout station for PCP. Like, well, everybody else has figured out this is terrible, so we'll. It was like the outlet mall of drugs or something, but way shittier. More like the closeout, the liquidation center. Dip it, sherm it, whatever. Just get it out of here.
Yeah, yeah. Get rid of the sherm.
Yeah. Dip your joints in it. Be my guest.
And I guess weed too was probably accessible.
Oh, weed was so everywhere that it wasn't even funny. And, you know, my parents were super into that stuff. So it was just logical that drugs would be something I would do. And smoking, because I looked super cool. And, you know, not really having any money, it was a great thing to really need.
Yeah. But I guess... I guess.
It's really convenient that I needed those. The logic is wild.
But you're young, right? Like, that's part of being young is learning.
Are you just going to lock your poor children in shackles?
I'm wondering that. Every day I think about this more and more. It's more like, as now an adult who's become a pothead in my 30s, how do you have a responsible drug conversation with your child when that time comes? But I think we're going to have to, I think we live in an era now where you're going to have to parent differently, because you can't assume that your kids don't, you can't, you know, deny that your kids know any of this stuff to yourself, because they do know everything. And so you have to just kind of broach it in more of a mature conversational way, I guess. I've got a few
years. My stepdad was really great with me about it. He was just like, just, you know, don't do anything stupid and call me. And so I never felt like I was going to get into any kind of horrible trouble or anything. And then, you know.
Yeah, I think my dad was the same way. Like, he unfortunately got divorced, and I had a stepfather who was not as understanding. But, yeah, like, that was the exact same thing. He's like, I've tried just about everything, so you're not going to shock me, but you can call me anytime you need to and talk about stuff. And I think that's, you know, that's the approach you have to have as a parent. But, you know, I still worry. I still may lock them up.
I get afraid just because I remember what I didn't know and what I was willing to try, and human nature of, like, you can hear it 10,000 times, but you have to burn yourself on the stove before you realize it's hot. So, yeah. Luckily, I had some, you know, deductive skills where I was like, oh, those people are dying of heroin overdoses. Living in complete poverty isn't the only choice there is, but it's just really hard to get out of. Or, you know, I could actually see a couple layers by a certain time. I don't know how, but because nobody was showing us that, that's for sure.
When I think drugs, you know, showed up on the Pacific Northwest in such a huge way, just from, like, obviously reading and from people I've talked to that were there, it became like real drugs really quickly. And I think in Toronto, like, obviously there was heroin and crack and cocaine and all this sort of stuff in punk, but it wasn't as pervasive, I don't think.
Well, this was like kind of pre-crack.
Yeah, I mean, sorry.
Like, it was still called crystal, crystal.
So just crystal.
And then crack happened, and you know, people would break into your car and smoke it in your car, and that was awesome because the smell is maybe the greatest smell you've ever smelled. I think big time, you know, heroin style and cocaine drugs were there the whole time. It's just the people that showed up. It's like, it was already there, but it was a small town. And then, like, around 90, 91, 92, like 2 million of the greediest people on earth moved to that area, like, bam. And everything was upside down. And, you know, the economy just was fluctuating so wildly, except in my town, which nobody would touch with a 10-foot pole. So we were just still loving our PCP and crystal and whatever else, whatever kind of, like, skanky secondhand bargain basement drugs they had. And there was a lot of heroin, though.
Yeah.
And I knew a lot of people who, you know, just kind of lost their way. And, you know, I knew people who would break into cars and steal stuff for a living to get crystal. And it was just part of your community.
Yeah.
I just thought everybody knew people who were doing that.
It's weird now because it feels like there was I don't know, in music, maybe I'm just naive, but it felt like drugs weren't as, like, not drugs, but really bad drugs weren't as prevalent or popular. And now it feels like drugs are back, like, in a big, big way. And especially, like, opiates and heroin and, like, oxy.
I'm told people are super into pills now.
Pills.
And I'm like, well, that sounds transportable.
Yeah.
And, you know, whatever. But I don't know. Drugs hold absolutely no fascination for me, and I fucking hate them, but, you know, I don't know why the tides of drugs do what they do or go, however, but basically back to the whole thing of punk rock, like it was just as big of a part of the scene as the music was for sure.
Well, back to the music, I guess, to get it back on a lighter subject. What were some of the bands around that time that were speaking to you after the Fastbacks? Like, were there other local bands that you saw that were like, God, this is awesome? Or,
well, No Means No played quite a bit because they were from Victoria, and they had that appeal to me that the Minutemen had, which was, it's not just music for dudes. It's music for people who think about stuff. And so I was really into them. God, I can't even tell. Like, there were so many bands I was into. I'm trying to think. This is the question that I'm going to screw up on being super jet lagged. So I'll just probably just vomit some names out as we keep talking.
No problem. I was going to ask you, kind of on the No Means No tip, at least sonically, did you ever see the Melvins in kind of the earlier days when they were?
Oh, yeah. I saw the Melvins a lot.
Yeah.
They were great. And still are, but I loved the Melvins. There was a club in Tacoma that I hung out at that was kind of short-lived, but it was called Community World Theater, and they played there a bunch, and Nirvana played there, and I remember Malfunction used to play there. So, mm-hmm. As the 80s progressed, it wasn't just hardcore bands anymore. It was bands that were kind of starting to mix it up a bit, which was interesting and excellent. And that, getting different kind of band, different kinds of bands like that in was definitely because of Jim May, the guy who ran the Community World Theater. He was very open-minded and just really loved music, and especially independent punk rock kind of music. And, we would get all kinds of stuff. And, Girl Trouble was really huge for me. That was a big deal. They're still a big deal to me.
Are they still going?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, because they did a record with Don Pyle actually like 2 years ago.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
They're awesome.
That's so awesome. Yeah, they're another band that's like, I guess maybe it's Pacific Northwest, but like another band that's kind of criminally underrated.
Yeah, they are indeed. And, we would get hardcore bands like DRI, and then we'd get like the Young Fresh Fellows. And then, it was a huge mixture of things, which was great. We'd get Flipper, and then we'd get Fang, and then we'd get, I don't know. Oh my God.
Another F band. So, we got to think of another F band.
Well, then Malfunction would come and be kind of this crazy, not a funk band, just this really weird band with Andrew Wood as Landry the Love God at the time. And they were just awesome.
Yeah, they were like everyone. Like, I don't know, once again, not a band I got to see, but I hear that they were almost like a stadium rock band, but like on a club rock level.
They were all about the showmanship.
Yeah.
And they were super fucking awesome, and they were super funny.
Was it the same sort of kids that were going to see a Malfunction show and a DRI, or was there changeovers in the crowd?
There were some changes over in the crowd. Like, some people would be really fucking gross military dudes who were pretending that they were punk rock dudes and just coming to beat people up and get drugs or whatever. And then there was really fucking creepy, skanky, skinhead kids, a lot of whom were secretly rich kids from the peninsula. And it was creepy. There were some real fucking creeps. And then there was just regular people who should have been in prison. And then there were people's kids.
Yeah. Yep.
And there were really adorable teenage kids who would hang out there too, who were just really super into music and super positive. Mm-hmm. So it was quite a mixture.
But would you see, would the skinheads or the weird military people show up to see a Malfunction show, or would it be more like, oh,
No, they'd be
band.
More like for DRI or something like that.
I guess, especially when crossover started happening, I imagine there'd be a little more of that.
Oh, yeah.
At that point.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, did you ever, what about Beat Happening in that whole scene? Did you ever Was that?
Yeah. There was a really great link between in the earlier 80s. Like, there was a great connection between Olympia and Tacoma at that time. It was super positive and friendly. And, you know, the dudes from K and Kill Rock Stars hung out all the time. And they would come to see bands that Olympia wasn't getting, and vice versa. It was really fun. And it was really chummy and really open. And then all of a sudden, it got really weird.
Oh, well, I guess when everything
Tacoma happened. Was just persona non grata.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We always kind of have been. But at the same time, like, I don't know. Not just Olympia, but, like, everybody just thought we were total scumbags.
Bizarre.
Which, I mean, it could be people were just scared, you know? Going to shows in Tacoma could mean, you know, your random, messed out military dude coming to beat someone's ass.
Yeah.
So that wasn't cool. But, I mean, I think more kind of horrible, violent shit really happened in Seattle than anywhere. But it was definitely a part.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
What were some of the Tacoma bands? Like, what were some of the bigger bands from Tacoma?
This is one I'm going to fuck up, even though I know them all. Because, if I fuck this up, I'm going to go to Tacoma and they're going to be like a tribunal. I'm going to have to pay some sort of penalty.
We'll move on. We'll move on to that question.
We'll get back to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to find out, because you did, you know, wind up playing in Cub and Mao and the Mint and New Pornographers and Nico Case and Mint Connection. Was there any of that happening at that point? Like, Cub starts a little later, right, than the Beat Happening. Well, I guess I always associate Beat Happening and Cub and sort of this like K Records early Mint paradigm, but maybe I'm just imagining it.
I think I wasn't so much a part of that. Like with Cub, I would fill in for their drummer who couldn't go all the time. And so I would play in the band. I didn't really write the music or anything, and I didn't have the same connections that they did, but I got them later just from hanging out with them. But I know that there was a bit of a Vancouver connection because CITR radio, you know, they were really into Washington bands, which was the Vancouver BC college station from UBC. And a lot of the people at Mint actually were DJs there and worked at the radio station. So there was that connection, and then Mint, which they made. And it was an isolated place at the time. Like, if bands were going to come to that area, they were going to do Vancouver and Seattle and maybe Victoria. People played Harpos a lot too. So I don't know. I'm terrible with exact timelines of things, but I do remember that there was a connection. At a certain point, I remember bands like The Smugglers and The Evaporators started playing down there a lot. And I remember Seaweed would play with them from Tacoma. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was a whirlwind.
And there was also like
that was like around like 1989, 1990. And they knew all the people from the Young Fresh Fellows and stuff, and the Crocodile opened, and, you know, things got a little more adult and different and not so dangerous, which was a relief. And, you know, Garage Shock up in Bellingham started, and, you know, we got different kinds of bands, and it was pretty killer.
Yeah, no, I think that's the thing is, like, it really, it feels like that was, I guess, when I don't know, as a Canadian kid, kind of getting into punk in the early 90s, and you'd hear about this sort of like mythical Pacific Northwest scene, and it'd be like, oh, all these bands are connected, and they're all, they must all be, live so close together to each other, or something like that. And I guess Mecha Normal.
In a way, yeah.
Yeah. And I guess Mecha Normal, too, would have been kind of crossing the
border. Yeah, Mecha Normal was everywhere.
Yeah.
They played all the time.
Yeah, and they did the record on K, and they were that's who I'm, that's my bridge band there. My point wasn't completely insane, like I thought it was going down that
the bridge band.
The bridge band. So how about yourself? Like you said, you started playing drums at 17. What were your first music projects like?
In my heart and mind, I kind of thought we were kind of going for being like the Cramps or something.
Yeah.
Because that's what I was really into. I was into really dirty, skanky, you know, I loved crazy rockabilly music. And I don't know, I learned a lot about music from the Cramps, which is, you know, a lot of people learned about a lot of music from the Cramps. So
oh, yeah.
We owe them.
They have a compilation big series. Time. They have that compilation.
Exactly.
Exactly. That taught me so much. I was going to say, did you like the U-Men at all then? Because they're kind of in that world.
Yeah.
I love that band.
Yeah. They were a huge Seattle staple.
Mm-hmm.
And then they became other bands too.
Yeah,
I guess. Crows, and I think some dudes in Gasshoffer. No, I can't remember.
Maybe Gasshoffer. You're right.
There's a lot of DNA shared by a lot of bands and a lot of people.
Absolutely.
Then people would just move to the Pacific Northwest at a certain point. So we got like the Super Suckers and stuff and all kinds of other bands.
I guess there's also all the Estrus stuff too, right? Like,
That was the whole garage talk.
Yeah.
And Estrus brought so many bands to the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
Which was a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and, you know, the Mono Men were really great.
Oh, incredible band. And Gasoline? Yeah. Is that Gasoline? Were they on Estrus? I'm trying to remember.
I don't know Gasoline. I don't think.
I don't know. I might be mistaken on the name. But so what was your first band called?
We were called the Propanes.
Awesome.
Or no, we were the Del Logs. That's right. We named ourselves after fireplace logs that you could buy at the store.
That was your first band, the Del Logs?
Mm-hmm.
Oh wow, that's crazy! Do you guys have a demo or anything?
Nope.
Wow, just
nope.
Just...
And the Propanes never did either. The Del Logs was myself, my friend Laura, and Greg and Andy, and we would practice at my friend Greg's house out in the country in Fife. And there was a dirty turkey that would come from the next door farm who would come over. She would come over to every practice, like. And gobble and just walk right in and poop on the floor. And it was just so fascinating. We would just kind of let it happen. Like, this turkey likes our music. And then I got in another band with my friend Sean Stern and John Atkins from Seaweed and my friend Lauren and myself. And we were an all-girl band with dudes in it. They loved to dress like women.
Well, I think the kids in the hall showed
us. They weren't mocking women. They just love to dress like women.
Yep. Straight guys love dressing like women is what the kids in the hall taught us.
That's right. And they owned it.
Yep.
And they were free to be you and me. It was good.
So did either of these bands, were you guys playing out, the Del Logs or?
The Del Logs a little bit, but the Propanes played a lot more. But we never played out of state or...
Yeah.
We never even played like Seattle or anything. I think we only ever played Tacoma.
Who were some of the bands you would have played with? Like, what were you finding yourself in that kind of garage rock scene because it's more rockabilly?
A little bit. I know we played with Girl Trouble. We played house parties. We played, I don't know. The Del Logs, our first show was only us, and we played at the Java Jive, which nobody had played at in a really long time. So I worked there, so I was Bob was sweet enough. Bob and Danny let us play there, which was bizarre, but super fun. I still have the poster from that show.
Wow.
Yeah.
How big is this poster trove?
It's pretty big. It's a pretty big poster trove.
Wow. I think you should put this out. I think you should. This is why, in addition to discovering Skype, you need to discover Instagram so you can share this with the rest of us. Now.
I have an Instagram account. I work too much, so I'm like, Twitter. I get because it's like you can only say so much, you know, and so. Instagram, obviously, I should get, and then it would go to Twitter, and everything would be great. But
it's hard.
I will make that step to actually putting it on my phone.
I was at this
eventually. I just got Skype today. I'm now in the now.
That's the thing. I was at this thing with all these university students the other day, not hanging out. I was there for work stuff, and someone mentioned Snapchat. And they were like, how many of you use Snapchat? And every person in the room, except for me, put up their hand. I was like, what the hell is this?
I've only heard the term Snapchat, but it's like, I don't want too much technology.
No.
Because, like, I don't need a new way to disappoint my friends by not getting back to them.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, I am the worst emailer. Yep. I don't have voicemail because I just can't figure out how to get it on my new phone. And I secretly love it. Yeah. I fucking hate voicemail, and I'm not, I'm good if you text me, because the information is there, and I don't forget it, but voicemail is like out of sight, out of mind. I don't remember that.
I hear you on this one. Emails especially. You forget about an email, it's gone. You might as well never send it.
Or if your email provider erases all your emails for you, that was cool.
Yeah, that sucks if that happens. Well, I think I would find that very freeing, because then those 700 that I haven't even opened would just be gone and I never have to worry about it again.
Well, it would be freeing if some of those people hadn't passed away and you were like sentimentally hanging on to their stuff or you want to get a hold of somebody I don't know.
No, you're right.
Freedom of choice.
You want the freedom
to delete my own emails.
I hear you on that
God
one.
God damn it.
Well, back to when that was not even a concern in the slightest. Mm-hmm. Where did you go? I guess you at a certain point, you go to Vancouver to go to university, right?
Yeah, I went to Emily Carr College of Art and Design, which is now called Emily Carr Institute.
Yeah.
It was ECIAD then.
I think it's
now
still...
it's super accredited and has a different name, which I'm terrible at remembering. It's probably...
I don't know if that's even a thing.
It's a school of dentistry now. Whoa. And I am a DDS.
Yes, you're now a dentist.
Yeah.
you got graduated into that program.
My next record will say Nego Case DDS.
That's awesome. That's a good name.
I will get my degree in maxillofacial surgery soon.
So when you what made you decide on Vancouver as somewhere to kind of go?
Well, I was friends with Karina Hammond, mm-hmm. Cece Hammond, who ended up being in Mao. Mm-hmm. Well, she and Toby actually started Mao and told me that I was in it. And I was like, okay. But Karina had gone to Emily Carr, and I checked it out because I really wanted to go to art school. And I loved it. And they had a program where if you lived in Washington State, you could go for the same price as a Canadian citizen. It was a good neighbor program. I literally was the last person to get that ever. So I was able to go to, a college for, the same price as community college. So obviously I would have been a fucking idiot if I didn't do that.
Yeah.
So I took out some loans and like busted my ass. And I got in, and I ended up living there for 4 years and playing with, Mao and Cub and the New Pornographers and my own band and, getting to know Canada, which felt totally right because when I was really little, I lived right on the border and we only had CBC. We didn't, because, there was no cable back then.
Yeah.
So we had CBC radio and CBC television. It was all like Beachcombers and Mr. Dress Up and Friendly Giant and, whatever was on CBC radio, which a lot of the time when I was a kid, it was Buffy St. Marie. So it did not feel like a stretch.
Yeah.
It felt like being at home still. I felt very much a part of that culture. And so I blended in and I loved it.
And it was weird. Like, that was also, I guess, Vancouver, at least music scene kind of coming into its own as well. Like, DOA had always been kind of doing its thing. And obviously the Canadian Subhumans are one of the greatest bands of all time, in my opinion, Point and Sticks. And we go on Digit Drags and all that stuff. But it felt like that kind of mint era was when, you know, like you started seeing it on Much Music or I would
say. Right. I mean, that was like 10 years later. And then, you know, Zampano and Superconductor were doing things like going on tour with Guided by Voices and stuff. And
yeah.
And Zampano was signed to Sub Pop. So, you know, they would be playing Seattle. And that was great. I was a huge Superconductor fan and then a huge Zampano fan. So. Yeah. It worked out.
So, but when you get, when you know, Mal starts going, like, that's sort of, that was the time I meant when, like, Mint was kind of coming into its own. Because Mal was, did it feel like, I don't want to say popular, but it felt like you guys were known right away.
That's totally not the experience I had, but.
That's the outside looking in.
It wasn't a negative feeling either. It sounds like I'm like, no, nobody liked us. We had a little bit of a hard time sometimes, like. You know, we would get offered shows with bands and then, like, that guy Keith from the Starfish Room would kick us off the bill because he didn't like our band. And we'd be like, you know, and I had a lot of balls as a young person, and I would just show up there and call him or whatever and be like, what's your problem with my band? You know, I guess you don't really do that. And he'd be like, well, I don't really like your band, but, and I'd be like, well, we have much right to play as anyone else. And if people are, you know, wanting us to play or like we, I don't know.
That's awesome.
It was just, I think back and I'm like, wow, I don't know how I was an aggressive kid.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think you probably had to be, maybe just from like seeing, like you said, there was like almost an aggressive at keeping women out of rock and roll, you know, an aggression.
Definitely.
In that.
And absolutely. And, you know, I had a really bad experiences with that in Seattle and mm-hmm. Tacoma mm-hmm. and Olympia, you know, earlier on. And it's just like, we can't put up with this.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I didn't feel like I was part of any kind of movement that was trying to help women out. It was self-interest.
Yeah.
And it was interest in the other women I knew. It was like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
You know, why is this happening? This is ridiculous. And so, but then, you know, as we traveled across the country and played shows and everything else, we just kind of started getting a bigger picture mm-hmm. and realizing like, yeah, it is kind of for other women too. Not that we were some massive, you know, leaders of any kind of revolution or anything. But, you know, there was definitely, you know, a lot going on before I left Tacoma, you know, like Bikini Kill and Bratmobile and all those bands that were, you know, kind of insisting like, yeah, you're going to let us play. We're
yeah.
going to play and you're going to, nobody's going to hit anybody. Mm-hmm. And nobody's going to yell, you suck. Mm-hmm. at me when I play, which, you know, that would happen. Like bands with women in it would play even at Community World Theater. And people were like, oh, girls fucking suck. And I'd be like, I'd hear it. And I'd be like, what era am I in?
Yeah.
But then, you know, bands were just starting out. So you're kind of like, well, the band's kind of maybe not that good, but at least they're doing, like, they're no worse than any other band that plays here. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Sorry, I just stuck a fish oil tablet in my mouth.
No, don't worry.
Why did I do that? I don't know.
Because you're looking out for your health, which is something you should do when you get off travel.
Yeah. Know? But it was definitely a very negative time for women in that kind of music.
Yeah.
You know, I don't really know what was going on in pop music at the time. Really don't. Like, sometimes I hear things and I'm like, oh yeah, that was happening. But, you know, I remember like Terrence Trent D'Arby and being like, oh, I like Terrence Trent D'Arby, you know. But other than that, like, I don't really know what was happening.
I think, wasn't it that was like the Can Rock Renaissance, wasn't
it? It was like Dan, it was like dentist office music on the radio.
And also, wasn't it like, was that still like Our Lady Peace, I Mother Earth?
No, that was way after when I'm talking about. I keep skipping around different times. Like, I'm talking about like mid-80s. Like, it was very male dominated.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm
like,
talking
white dudes.
Oh, yeah,
sure. Kind of young white dudes, you know, which there's nothing wrong with young white dudes making music, but that's the only people that were making music. And it was all kind of like the style was, you know, political rhetoric that they didn't come up with.
Yeah.
Smash the state, you know.
Yeah.
It was fucking stupid
at
a certain point. And, you know, if women tried to be in bands, people would be real dicks about it.
I think
unless you were like Tootie of Dead Moon or something, and nobody fucked with Tootie of Dead Moon, which was awesome. Mm-hmm. I don't remember Bon from Girl Trouble getting any shit either, but I'm not Bon, and I'm sure she did get a lot of shit. So who knows? But I just remember seeing these women treated that way, and sometimes I would buy into it because I'd be like, yeah, that band's not very good. Maybe women do suck in music, and then those feelings and thoughts were very short-lived, and then I was like, what the fuck am I thinking? Mm-hmm. And I realized, I'm just jealous that I'm not in a band. And then once I got in a band, everything changed, and I was like, okay, yeah. The way to be in a band is not to hate all the other bands, but to get to know all the other bands and help them out.
Yeah.
And they help you. Like, duh.
Yeah.
It's just a really super obvious learning curve that happens, hopefully, to people.
I think it still needs to happen to some people today. Like, guys.
I know. Isn't it weird when you meet people who are in their 40s who are bitter about something that did or didn't happen?
Oh,
you're
yes.
like, dude, it's not sports.
Yes.
If it didn't happen for you, it might not even have anything to do with you, but dude, come on. You're like, are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah. I can see it though, right? Like, I think that's the, because it's all, you know, like these, you get power from the bitterness. And it becomes your strength.
The vitriol is a very short-lived power source. It's like eating, you know, Captain Crunch for breakfast with Butterfinger milk as opposed to like some oatmeal.
That sounds incredible though. That's one hell of a breakfast.
It's an incredible righteous feeling, and then your mouth's all cut up and you feel like shit and you go back to bed. And if you're me, you get a rash on your face.
I love Captain Crunch and I love buttermilk, so I'm going to try it once and hopefully
not Butterfinger milk.
Butterfinger, like that's what I meant.
Candy milk.
That's what I meant.
Ooh.
Butterfinger.
Then you have a much more refined palate than I do.
You don't like Butterfingers?
Like, oh, it's too sweet. No. Oh. Yeah, I do, but they're too sweet. I can't eat them anymore.
That's true. I can't. Like, I'm not saying I'm sucking them back right now, but I do. When the road weakness takes me and we stop at a truck stop, I'm grabbing a Butterfinger. This podcast is now sponsored by Butterfinger, apparently.
Crispy Crunch, if you're Canadian.
They don't have Crispy Crunch in America?
God, no.
What? Wow, that's crazy. I never knew that. Wow. I know they don't have, those maple candies that we have up here, those disgusting maple candies.
Oh, we do in Vermont.
Oh, Vermont,
we got maple candies coming out the yang, but.
Do they have maple donuts in Vermont?
No, we have apple cider donuts.
But you don't.
We call them maple bars in Washington. Those were everywhere.
Yeah, maple bars. Yeah.
I loved a maple bar when I was a kid. The ones with chocolate on them, I was confused. I was like, why would I get that when there's a maple bar?
Yeah.
Now I understand. But as a kid, it was like that was the number one donut selection.
Head.
Bear Claw maple bar. What's it going to be, Dad?
It always surprises me that you don't see. Like, I don't know, I guess you maple donuts more often in the United States, but maybe I just haven't been looking at the bars. I need to look more at the bars and less at the donuts at this point.
I think I need to now I'm like, I should really travel the backwoods of Washington State and see if they still offer rectangle-shaped maple bars. Like, well, I hope we still have them.
Well, this is actually, you know what? I bet you they have those at Voodoo Donuts in Portland. That seems like something.
Oh, Voodoo Donuts can fuck off. That
you
place
don't like,
is gross.
You don't like Voodoo Donuts?
No, those are tourist donuts.
Why?
And they're like Krispy Kreme in that they're so sweet. Like,
Oh.
I like the dough.
So
I want to taste also the dough.
I Voodoo Donuts, they do have the ones that have the dough on it. Like the Tang Donut has dough taste. It has the doughy taste.
Ugh, no. Huh. Gross.
Well, I want to say this, like, not that I'm, like, proclaiming that I'm a local or anything in Portland, but I've been going there before the Food Network show featured it, and back when Fucked Up was buying the day-old vegan donut buckets for $1, and let me tell you.
I don't believe in blue food coloring being in food, ever.
Ah.
Blue and green food coloring does not belong on my food. And there's a lot of that going on. And at that point, I'm like, if I see blue or green food coloring on something, to me, it's just going to taste like gumballs, which is disgusting.
Oh, is that the blue? Is that like a flavoring thing in gumballs?
Well, it's what you can taste in gumballs besides the disgusting gumball flavor.
Yeah, gumballs do taste disgusting.
They're fucking gross. And that's what everything that's blue and green tastes like to me. But, I mean, it could be a psychosomatic reaction to seeing the blue and the green. I don't know.
Well, Nico, now you've ruined gumballs
apparently
and donuts for me.
Apparently, I'm a total dickish snob about donuts and bubblegum. Red cream soda. Fuck off.
Yeah.
I don't ever want to see that. I don't want to drink it because it tastes like gumballs, which are disgusting.
You know, in Canada, it's red cream soda except in Quebec, where it's clear.
Is it just straight up vanilla though, or is it that gross gumball flavor?
I think it's just straight vanilla.
I think we're gonna need to meet up in Quebec and have a summit.
I think we do. I think Nico, I wanted to say
we'll go to the croissant school and we'll test out some fucking. We'll have the almond croissants to measure the. I don't know. That's just a fantasy I have.
Going to almond croissants and eating sounds like a fantasy that all of us should have. I want to do that.
I know, and then we'll test out some cream soda. I'll bring some Dr. Brown's up or something, or Boylan's, which is also good.
And we can also get poutine because you know what's weird? They don't have that in Wisconsin. How can they not have that in Wisconsin?
I don't know. I'm sure they will eventually. We have it. We now have it in Vermont, and you can get Skinny Pancake is the place that has really good poutine. A lot of places say it's poutine, and then it's like if you don't use a fucking cheese curd, it's not poutine.
True.
Like, can you get the word out to people? Like, you can't shred up cheddar, and it's poutine.
Lick's Hamburgers in Toronto does that. Like, they have shredded cheese on it. It's like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
You can't do this. Like
no self-respecting Quebecer would ever say that was poutine.
Not at all. Well, Nico, I've kept you longer than I was supposed to, and I could talk to you honestly all day, but I know you just got off a flight, and I would love to have you on for a part two in some point in the future, and we can meet up and do this in person.
Say the word. I would love to be on, and I hope I've answered some questions about punk.
You have honestly, like, there's so much more stuff I have left on my question sheet that I wanted to get to because I got trapped in the Seattle music wormhole that you created, but it was a very pleasant place to be. Believe me, I love talking about all that stuff. Thank you so much.
I do too. Thank you for asking because it was a great time.
It was awesome.
And I make it sound terrible with all the drugs and stuff, but you know, a lot of people were smarter than that and really just got the music out of it, and it was a really interesting place to live, and it was tiny and lots of cool stuff was happening.
Absolutely. And you think about how much amazing music came out of that scene, from like, you know, Duff and Guns N' Roses to yourself to like Nirvana to like the Melt, like all this Poison Idea to Dead Moon to Girl Trouble to Fastbacks.
Oh, I love Poison Idea.
Oh, we didn't even talk
all
about
those bands. And, you know, everybody knows it for Nirvana and stuff, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. I love Nirvana. And, you know, that's a very important touchstone.
Well, can I ask you?
But, the variety coming out of there was huge. Huge. It wasn't just, quote unquote, grunge music.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I wanted.
No, it's okay.
Every time I talk to someone who's from that region, who knows about, who's like a Nirvana or saw Nirvana, do you get off the train after Bleach? Or are you into Nevermind, too?
No, I love Nevermind.
Okay. Yeah, some people you talk to from that region, they're like, or not even that region, who are Bleach fans, don't go to Nevermind.
Well, if they didn't go to Nevermind, they probably were just sad. not sad because they were dumb, but because it was just kind of a sad era. Things were kind of going a bit south. And it was sad for obvious reasons. Things were falling apart and it was obvious. And that hurts a lot.
Do you think that ended like the period of American independent music? Like obviously that scene continues and there's underground bands that continue on and there's other underground
It just ended the major label interest in it.
Yeah.
After the major labels signed everyone they could and then lost a bunch of money, then they were like, okay, the well is dry. And then there was just the sound of the ocean just and, you know, every great place to play or practice disappeared. More like, I mean, Seattle dried up and, you know, like I said, 2 million of the greediest people on earth moved there fast, bought everything. And you couldn't, like, a practice space was, by the time I moved back from Canada to Seattle in 98, and I think I actually lived in the last live workspace you could get a place at because I had a friend who'd lived there forever and I became his roommate, and then seconds later it just became condos and I was like, okay, that's it. The writing's on the wall. Like, I can't afford to live here anymore. I have to leave. So I went to Chicago.
Well, I guess we'll pick it up in Chicago next time.
We can indeed.
Nico, thank you so much again for doing this.
Thank you, sir. It has been an honor and a pleasure.